Welcome to episode 14 of the Cordyceps Crew, an unofficial podcast for HBO's The Last of Us. My name is Richie, and I'm joined by my partner in crime, Klupp.
Hello.
And today, we'll be reminiscing on our introductions to gaming and how that led us to playing The Last of Us. And welcome back, everybody. It's been 2 weeks, the first little break that we had. Feel well rested and ready to go as well. We had a little 3 hour nap before this. feel a little bit bad for making Klupp wait, but you know, I think he'll forgive me.
I can't
me.
Tell you the last time I've had a true blood nap, but that's, you know, that's neither here nor there.
Maybe you're more angry than the fact that I took a nap. Like, it's kind of like a slap in the face.
I'm actually jealous. I'm living vicariously through you because it's not something I feel like I'll be able to do for another like 6 months. So,
oh man. Yeah, it's, you know, we had to take some time, just some time off. It'll happen from time to time. We'll always let you guys know when that'll happen beforehand. Hopefully, you know, if you follow me on Twitter, you know, or to follow the Cordyceps Crew on Twitter, you will have seen that announcement as well as from the episode. So, you know, if you want news and announcements and things like that, you know, go on to our socials and get those things.
Join the thriving Twitter community.
The thriving Twitter community that everybody loves and there are no flaws. But yeah, so I mean, that brings us into our first note. I mean, that was not like the smoothest segue, but basically, keep reading us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, you know, wherever you can. Leave us some reviews, comments, all of these things. They help drive, you know, help the podcast grow, and they drive interaction with you guys. And of course, you could always email us as well at cordycepscrew@gmail.com, and we will answer your questions and concerns. That and the fact that next week, we're not taking another week off, you know. We're going to try. We're going to keep going. Next week, we'll be covering the first part of our playthrough of The Last of Us Part 1. So our aim is to get to the end of the prologue. It just feels important to cover that in great detail because it is such an iconic moment in not just The Last of Us, but like it feels like in gaming history, like in a lot of ways. Yeah. It seems like it's like a very
It's a watershed moment in narrative gaming history is the prologue alone.
Yeah, I think a lot of games and, you know, developers realized after seeing it, you know, like, oh, wow, we can actually make people feel something for these video games that we're making. And, you know, it's not just reserved for, you know, books and movies and things of that nature. So, I'm definitely excited to get into the playthrough and talk about it. I said I would try to record some gameplay so that and put it onto YouTube. It seems easy enough. I've been looking into it, seeing how to do it. It's not going to be anything like totally, you know, if you're looking for like PewDiePie level of production
value.
We
don't have a crack production squad. It'll just be Richie on his own.
Yeah, exactly. Which, you know, for most of us is probably fine. You know, just watching somebody play it that you know, and just a personality and that you're used to and accustomed to. But yeah, my production skills are not quite as well versed when it comes to video yet. So we're getting there though. With this episode, we're talking about our personal gaming history. It just seems important for us to, before we get into the Last of Us playthrough, just for you guys to know a little bit about where we came from, and not even just that, but just to maybe reminisce with us about probably many people's lives that are listening right now as just being gamers and being kind of in tune with that community. And it's always fun to kind of go back and remember the things that that you did to get here. So I'm pretty excited about it. I just have like a few prompting questions, and we'll go back and forth and share our experiences. And yeah, I'm probably Klopp was saying that he's going to learn some stuff about me, and I hadn't even thought about that. Like, I know some of Klopp's gaming experience, but I don't know all of it, you know. So it's going to be interesting to see, you know, what kinds of things shaped a childhood Klopp into the man he is today. So without further ado, let's get into the first question. What was your first gaming console or device, and what was your experience with it like? And we're about to age ourselves here.
Yeah.
So
I mean, not as much as others, but
definitely not as much as
I wasn't allowed to get a gaming console for a very long time. So the kind of console du jour for my generation, when kids my age were allowed to get consoles, was the Nintendo GameCube. And people were playing, Legend of Zelda The Wind Waker, or Super Mario Sunshine, or, you know, any of the, you know, Mario Karts or Super Smash Bros. Like, all of those games on GameCube, I was dying to play, and I wasn't allowed to get one. But my parents let me get a Nintendo DS when that came out in, like, 2005 or 2006. So my first, I got really big into handheld gaming, and that's something that's kind of stayed with me. And then eventually when the Wii came out, my parents let me get one of those. So my first gaming console were Nintendo consoles, which I feel like is probably a pretty standard. I mean, Nintendo has a very low bar to entry in terms of cost and user access, and their games are obviously also iconic. But I fell in love with Zelda and Metroid and Mario and a lot of the kind of cornerstone franchises in Nintendo's catalog. And that's why I'm a big proponent of gameplay and sandbox explore, or, you know, like the way that developers explore and develop sandboxes and really kind of fine tuning the gameplay portion of experience. Obviously I care a lot about the other elements of video games, but I think a game can really live and die on how solid its gameplay loop is. So that was my first video game console, was the Nintendo DS, followed up by the Wii.
That's interesting. I actually thought you might have been a later bloomer than I was, the Wii, I'm looking it up right now.
Wii is 2006.
So was that before or after original Xbox, or at the same time?
Original Xbox was like 2001. So
wow. So
that was concurrent. That was around the same time as the Xbox 360. They were the same generation.
Okay. So I thought you were going to say that. I thought you were going to be like Xbox, like original. Nope. But damn. Well, I mean, it kind of makes sense though. It makes, you know, you do like the, like you said, the sandbox environments. I feel like, you know, you are always on the Zelda train. I remember when we were in college, we even played a little bit of Wind Waker. We kind of did like a little retro revisit of Wind Waker.
I had to order some special hardware just to hook it up to the TV. But I had a lot of friends that were quote unquote friends just so I could go over and play on their GameCubes, because I was so like frothing at the mouth to get into video games.
That's, and you know,
what about you? What was yours?
Yeah, so for me, my first gaming console was actually the Nintendo 64. And I consider myself, I mean, this is interesting, right? Because I consider myself to be kind of a late bloomer. My parents definitely were the last people to let me get a console.
But the 64 came out in like the mid 90s.
So here's the thing. So I think that it was a compromise, right? Like, it was definitely, it was like getting the old used car, you know, as your first car, right? Like, it's new to you, but not new to the world. So I now that I think about it, like, I think when I got my Nintendo 64, you know, it was around the time that the original Xbox and original PlayStation were coming out. So, you know, my friends had those things, and then I had, you know, Nintendo 64, which was not a problem for me. I didn't care. I actually had to ask Santa Claus to get it for me. That just to give you some perspective, listeners, of how young I was. When I got my first console and, you know, I had to.
He was 12.
Yeah, that was last year. It was last year. I wrote Santa Claus. But yeah, I remember playing games like Star Fox, Madden 99, Donkey Kong. Like that was a lot of my introduction to gaming. Star Fox 64, I think I probably played that game 100 times. There was something I have, you know, much like our character Ellie in The Last of Us, I have an obsession with space and something about flying around in space and shooting things and exploring planets seemed extremely novel to me as a kid, and it is still novel. I think we'll talk about this a little bit more too in our second question, but it was definitely something that I felt like a late bloomer because my friends around me had other things going on. But I don't, you know, it didn't matter in the grand scheme of things. You know, I think we'll get into our second question now because it all has to do with this. But like, you know, can you like recall some specific gaming moments or games that defined your childhood? And I guess I'll let you. You want me to go first, or you want to go first?
You go first. Okay. I want to refine my answer while you're.
Sure, sure. So we both have mentioned kind of like going over to friends' places. And I think this element of gaming has changed quite a bit. And I think that, you know, of course we had the Battlefields, the Call of Duties, the Halos, and a lot of those games definitely shaped my childhood. But the things that I remember most are actually games like Kirby Air Ride, Super Smash Brothers. There was a game my friend had, talk about a retro console. My friend had, we would go to his house. He had a Sega Dreamcast, and we would play a game called Rush. It was like a racing game, I guess you can call it, but you basically like you would like battle cars and pick like these power ups, and you would fly. They would have wings, and you would fly around, and it was like. But I guess my point is like each. Like I remember the games where you got together with your friends and you played, split screen, and I think that I remember even really when it started to die off. I don't know if you remember the exact moment.
It was,
but
I feel like it was for me the moment of the death of split screen was, Halo 5 releasing in 2015 mm-hmm. without split screen, and Halo was a landmark split screen franchise. You know, like yes. LAN parties and Halo split screen are almost like, you know, synonymous with multiplayer experience, like shooters. Obviously that they're not the first and the only, but when a Halo game launched without couch co-op, I think that to me was like, oh, it's really happening. Like it's going.
I remember it also being Halo. Like, so like for the younger audience that might be listening, like that was the experience. I mean, this might be still true, but I tend to think not so, but like you would go, I would go to my friend's house, or we would decide before coming home from school, hey, like we want to play X game. We want to play Kirby Air Ride today. And Kirby Air Ride was literally just like, again, it was like just a racing game, but like we would play it in a way where you built bases and you would have these cars and you would crash the cars into each other essentially. And you know, there was like the Mattress Mobile was a strong car and everybody fought over that. So, but the point is that we would plan our day or getting home around who had what game. Like, I was like, okay, my friend, I don't think he minds me saying his name. My friend Andrew, he has Kirby Air Ride. So we're going over to his house today. right? Or my friend Noah, he has Battlefront 2, which is the original Battlefront 2. So we're going over to his house today. And that was a lot of my childhood. Ribbit King was a game that nobody's ever played in their entire life, but I had it on GameCube. Basically, it was golf with a frog. You would hit a mallet into the frog, and it would go into a well, and that's how you scored strokes, just like in golf. But yeah, I mean, like, depending on what game we wanted to play, that's where we went. And I remember the Xbox 360 when they, this is a novel concept that if you didn't have an Xbox 360, it's going to blow your mind. But it, you had to get, remember you had to get that adapter to play online?
Yeah,
it was.
Yep, there was a, it was a online wireless connector thing that you had to do mm-hmm. to connect to like, yeah.
Yeah, it was. It cost like $100. It wasn't cheap, right? It was like you just convinced your parents, right, to get this. You know,
online functionality. There was significant gateways to doing it. Yeah. You know, like couch co-op was the necessity, was the normal, and. Yeah, there were significant gateways. You know, it's funny that those are a lot of your memories, because those are mine as well. A lot of my fondest memories of early gaming are really discovering gaming through the first time through, like, sitting down at, you know, my cousin's house playing his GameCube or going to friends and discovering for the first time how vibrant and immersive games could be.
Yeah.
Because I'm an avid reader and have been for my entire life. I've become a cinephile later in life, but I wasn't a huge movie person when I was a kid. You know, I watched like the same three movies over and over again, but I was an avid reader. But video games provided this whole new kind of escapism. So I think when you're young and you pick up a game, you know, like I'll use Legend of Zelda: The Wind Waker as an example, because it has an open-ish world. You know, there's like, you know, the great sea that you can sail between islands at will. And there's definitely a path that's charted throughout the game. But for the most part, like, if you open your map and you see an island there, you can just chart and go. Mm. And the game felt endless in a way that just I was unable to comprehend. And it made every game feel endless. Like, even if you're playing, you know, Pokemon, which is such a linear franchise, you know, you go on Route 1, there's, you know, an X amount of different avenues you can like poke your head into before you get to the next town and over again. But like the way those games are structured, it feels like there's secrets behind every corner. Like, oh, there's a truck sitting out here. Like, is there a secret Pokemon sitting behind this truck? Do I have to like walk around it 37 times? Like the internet, like, you know, like there was no internet back there. I mean, there was internet. I'm not trying to, but like,
we're not that like, old. We're not that old.
Yeah. But you know, rumors would kind of go through hearsay, and the internet wasn't robust enough to like dispel these rumors. And so, you know, there was the rumor that in Pokemon Red and Blue, there was a truck that a Mew was hiding under. And if you spent enough time at the truck, like you could catch a Mew, and that was the only way you could do it. And like, I didn't know any better. Like those kinds of things, because the internet was not robust enough. Like gaming was just so full of wonderment and possibility and immersion and vibrancy. And so much of that I experienced through going to friends' houses. So, yeah, like Legend of Zelda and Mario on the GameCube, playing. And then when I started to get into online multiplayer games, when they really started, you know, bursting onto the scene, I found RuneScape, and that absolutely blew my mind. Like MMORPGs fucking blew my mind.
As it did for a lot of people.
And then Halo 3 on the Xbox 360 is really what turned me into an Xbox gamer, because, you know, for everything that Nintendo has, what they don't have is a competent online infrastructure that carries on to this very day. But yeah, like the Halo 3 online multiplayer experience, like something about that shifted in me a whole new realm of possibilities for what a sandbox can be. And how you can share that sandbox with people and just create crazy things that can happen when you're trying to win a competitive match. It's just like the years between 2000 and like, I'd say like 3 and 2007, any game released in there, I was just all in on, you know, every game I wanted to experience. And everyone had like an impact on me in a different way, I would say.
Yeah, so that I'm glad you said the Halo 3 thing, because I think that is this game specifically where I felt the switch actually take place, because it was like a transitional period, because you had that was the first game where they had like the editing thing. It was the what do they call it?
Forge mode. It's a map building.
Yeah, so like that was fun to do in person. Like, you would go to somebody's house and you would do Forge mode. You'd like make these bases. You know, you'd build them, and then, you know, you try to shoot each other from the base you just made in the Forge mode. It was like a really fun thing to do. But on the other hand, it was like, well, online multiplayer is really fun and I want to play competitively. And sure, like, you can play as, you know, my guest, but I want to unlock all this, you know. I mean, there wasn't a lot to unlock in Halo, I don't really think. But I mean, there were different, like, you had to get like certain gear, I remember, and that you had to kind of do on your own, and you couldn't do that if you were at your friend's house. It was like a
status symbol, yeah. You know? Yeah.
So you had to, it kind of turned into like, that's like the moment where it really turned into like, oh, like, I'll see you later on, you know, online. Like, we'll get in an Xbox party. Like, that's when that really started for me. It was like, you know, I remember that little freaking adapter thing, I attribute all of that change to that little fucking adapter.
I mean, I still played so much Halo couch co-op.
Yeah, for sure.
What I think is really interesting about Halo 3, though, and, you know, video games have been a community since video games have been in existence, because, you know, it started out as a niche ownership thing, and then, you know, grew, but the video game community was still rather small. But the way that the Halo 3 online community grew organically around Forge mode, around sharing screenshots and cool clips and stuff, like, the way that people took Halo 3 and ran with it was just this really interesting, you know, organically grown online community that I think was a really, you know, a big watershed moment for gaming, in the way that, you know, now I feel like almost every game has its little online community, its little like tribal, you know, vibrant online community of people sharing clips and being obsessed with every little detail of the game. And I feel like Halo 3 was the first game to really do that, kind of on accident, really. You know, the developers provided the tools and the community just ran with it.
Yeah,
it did. And that was a really special thing to be a part of.
Yeah, it did really feel like that community feel. I mean, and like you were saying something before about, you know, like these little, like the Mew thing, and like having to run around the truck and, you know, start thinking that that's how you got Mew, or like things of that nature. Like, I definitely bought, I don't know what it was, what game it was, but I definitely remember buying at least one of those, like not a manual for the game, but like a guide, like the guide for the game. Yeah. And that's completely been, I mean, I'm sure they still make them, but like, it's such a novelty now, because you could just go onto YouTube and people literally will tell you exactly where to go and the correct way or the most efficient way of completing a game, or like where to get this trophy or this collectible. And it's, you know, all that was, like you said, word of mouth and, you know, getting sometimes you would go to somebody's house because they had the guide. Like, that's what you would do.
Yep.
Like, they had the guide. They're like, oh, okay. Like, this is where you get this thing. And I don't know, there's something very novel about that I miss, but, I don't think that would have survived forever, just because there's so much more money in online gaming and, you know, transactions of that nature. So, we kind of touched on it, but like, what were some of your favorite games in the early 2010s? I guess Halo was that early 2010s.
So Halo 3 was 2007 to 2010 when then Halo Reach came out, and then Halo 4 came out in 2012.
Okay,
so when Halo came out, my attention definitely phased away from Nintendo and handhelds towards Xbox, basically exclusively, at that period of time. So, another watershed gaming moment was discovering the Elder Scrolls IV Oblivion, because, I mean, you want to talk about crazy Western style RPGs. I mean, that really opened a new door for me too. Because Nintendo has some incredible games, but nothing of that kind of depth and complexity. You know,
and I mean, style. It's not,
you could
like,
say that
it's not their style at all.
Not at all. So around that time in the late 2010s, around the time when The Last of Us was early 2010s, I was very big into playing Halo 4 with my roommate in college. I was still fresh off of playing Elder Scrolls 5 Skyrim, just like the rest of the world. I mean, I played that all the way through. I definitely played other kind of single player games. I really liked, I believe Dishonored was released 2012, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh man, I remember that.
Dishonored, which is a first person kind of stealth action RPG light game, set around assassinating targets and kind of sandboxy environments. Again, just what I like. And Bioshock One and Bioshock Infinite, which came out in 2013. I mean, we've built up The Last of Us as kind of like the early watermark in narrative gaming. But, you know, it's not like narrative complexity didn't exist in games at that time. That's just kind of the popular example. But Bioshock Infinite, and really both all of the Bioshock games, the narrative complexity and, you know, thematic brilliance of those games cannot be understated.
Yeah.
And they predate Last of Us. So I think right before I played the Last of Us for the first time when it was released, which again, I played at a friend's house, I was playing Bioshock Infinite, and that game just blew my socks off. That game was incredible.
It's now it's funny you say that, because I Bioshock Infinite was the only game, I have a weird, I'm very strange and picky when it comes to games. I don't know why this is, but I'm known for this even in Discord today. But Bioshock Infinite and not Dead Island, I know that just came out, but it was Left 4 Dead were the two games that I went back to GameStop and actually returned.
Really?
Yeah, Bioshock Infinite was one of them. And didn't surprise you, because I do have weird takes on like really popular games like Zelda, Zelda Breath of the Wild. I was not a big fan of, but wasn't getting the vibe. And maybe if I had played the original Bioshock, it would have been different. But
maybe,
I don't know. It just like
it does invert it. It is a complete like in terms of setting and thematics, it is a complete 180 inversion of the original Bioshock, which I think it's a game that stands on its own merits, but it's also very fascinating as a sequel. But
I just wasn't ready for it, man. I don't know. Maybe I just wasn't
it's,
ready.
It's an intense game.
Yeah.
It is hard to follow. It's a lot of shit happens. Yeah. It's a phenomenal game, and you're wrong if you don't like
it. Yeah. I was going to say, it's definitely a hot take. It's definitely a hot take to go and return that game. Left 4 Dead, not as much in my opinion.
Yeah. I didn't really connect with Left 4 Dead.
I think that game's a little overrated, but that's beside the point. But yeah, it's interesting to kind of, it was actually, I like this question. This is one of the questions you put on here. And because I went in and I'm like, I think I know what games are early 2010s. And you'd be surprised what games make it in that category. I think there's like a very diverse, I think this is where like some developers were really making like headway and getting ahead of others. It was around this era. Cause now it's pretty even, right? Like there's not any developer, that's doing things that are drastically much more crazy and much more advanced than others. Like I mean there is this new like independent game called Unrecord or Record or something.
Yeah.
You've probably seen clips on it on TikTok if you're into that sort of thing. But other than that, like there's nothing crazy. You know, it's like everybody's kind of on the same playing field. Like Mass Effect, for example, is a game that came out in 2007. Now, if you ask me, like, that's around the time that, like, other games of, like, I don't know, like, when you think about it, like, Last of Us came out, what, in 2013? I guess that is a lot of time. That is 6 years. But, I mean, the difference between Last of Us and Mass Effect, like, Mass Effect people thought was, like, the story game for a while. And,
yeah.
And, like, I replayed it recently, and it is hard, like, it is hard to get through, man. It was, like, actually, like, some of the voice acting is just, like, out of control bad. Like, just like, and I'm not saying that the game is bad. I know I'm like alienating a lot of people here and being like,
some of those like early, like pioneering type games definitely don't hold up, but it is, I think the decade between 2000 and 2010 had so many like monumental leaps forwards in terms of types of different games. Obviously, like the decade before that, you had, you know, like the Super Nintendo and the Nintendo 64, some of the most important video games ever made. But the 2000s, in terms of like video game diversity, like that's when video games really started to branch out into weird and wonderful, you know, massive RPGs, space operas, you know, video games really started to branch out in that decade. And, you know, it's early exploration. So not all of it kind of holds up as well as I think some people think it does.
Yeah.
But it's still kind of like, it's important to know where the games you're playing now came from.
I guess it's not fair that I was comparing it to The Last of Us because it is six.
No,
but I see it as like a similar, like, I think that people looked at Mass Effect as the game that changed the game. You know what I mean? Like, it was like, this is like more, there were things that it was doing that people connected with on a different level where it's like, oh, like, these, I can make choices, and these choices, and games were doing this, by the way, before, but it was like, it was just seen as
choices mattered.
Like, choices really seemed like they mattered. And like, there was a level of production that just seemed like it was in a completely different direction, like just like different facial expressions and things like that. Like that sort of stuff was kind of secondary before games like Mass Effect came out. But I mean, that wasn't even on my list of games that were my favorite in the early 2010s. I mean, to think that, you know, The Walking Dead, Portal, those games to me, like The Walking Dead is, I had to check it because I was like, is that really early 2010s? But like, it is, it seems like it wasn't that long ago, but, this came out in 2012, and I guess that counts, right? No, it doesn't.
Yep.
Well, kind of. But yeah.
Yes. Any game that came out before The Last of Us.
Yeah. So, Witcher 3 came out in 2015, right? I mean, that was around the same time as The Last of Us. And, you know, of course I had, you know, I think Rocket League was...
Rocket League was 2015. I was thinking games that came out like before The Last of Us that you were playing leading up to the first time you might have been exposed to The Last of Us. But
I mean, it's so hard to like, because I think that my gaming experience had really become at that point like multiplayer oriented.
Yeah, me too.
And I think that
mostly.
Yeah, it was really whatever the flavor of the month was up until like, you know, every once in a while you'd have a game come around from single player that really was like iconic. Portal for me was like one of those, the first PC game, because I really wasn't a PC gamer at all, that came around and I was like, oh, there's like really different kinds of games out there. Like there's like some really like just like very simple concept, but like, you know, very like Portal has like some of the more interesting like dialogue and like voice. It's like a very funny game, and it's like it's very different than, you know, anything I had ever played. But yeah, it feels like a lot of that period was kind of muddled for me until things like The Last of Us came around, honestly. So I guess my next question would be, I guess, is like, why The Last of Us, you know, like all these games of leading up to this point, like why Why are we so involved and emotionally involved in The Last of Us specifically? And are there any other games or genres that you feel particularly passionate about? So I don't know if you want to take this one first or me go.
Sorry. I know I've been kind of jumping on this, but I think it was around the time of The Last of Us that that the kind of quote unquote console wars had reached a fever pitch. So this is when you know, Microsoft, Sony, and Xbox were all competing, or have been competing head to head for about 2 decades now. Where Nintendo competes on a different marketing strategy entirely, different games, different hardware. Sony and Xbox have always gone kind of head to head. You know, they have a lot of the same third party titles, but their first party titles can be in direct competition, but they employed the same type of hardware, the same marketing strategy. They basically just try to one up each other on, you know, their various competing business lines. Right. Mm. So I'm obviously, you know, super passionate about Nintendo games because I cut my teeth on them. But, you know, once I got my Xbox and got really into the Halo community, and then I was really into everything that was available on Xbox. But for the most part, I played a lot of third party games. And I love the Halo community so much that it was kind of a mix of, like, you know, third party games on Xbox and then Halo. And I, you know, the Microsoft online infrastructure is still so much better than any of the other competitors.
Yeah.
That's what I really valued. But at the same time as this, Sony was kind of going about and developing, like, a really intensive catalog of first party titles. Like, you know, Nintendo has an unbeatable catalog of first party titles, but Sony was coming up with different kind of art house stuff, whereas Nintendo had these kinds of, like, you know, all ages blockbusters, you know, your Marios and your Zeldas and your Kirbys and whatever, what have you.
Mm-hmm.
Sony was coming out with Shadow of the Colossus. You know, God of War isn't really a art house thing, but, you know, like, Ico and, I'm thinking of other, you know, Sony titles of the day, but
I think it was just, like, more that they were trying to go for something much different. It seemed like
I would say, like, cinematic story driven.
Yeah.
Gameplay on a level that other developers weren't exploring. Like, there's plenty of developers that had games that had great stories. Yes, you know, or for the day, like Mass Effect, BioShocks, even I would say, like, Assassin's Creed or some of these other games that were releasing at the time. These games, like, contained great stories, but the stories were not the driving focus.
Mm.
Whereas Sony was starting to explore games where the narrative was the focus and the gameplay kind of came second.
Yeah.
And that was the major shift for their developmental pipeline. And so people that bought PlayStation, you know, had that in their arsenal, where they had these games that were not driven by gameplay, where the narrative was a plus. It was driven by the narrative and the gameplay was a plus. And, mm-hmm. The game that perfected that balance was The Last of Us. And I was kind of like a, you know, an Xbox fanboy, and I was kind of like, you know, an apologist basically. And when The Last of Us came out, obviously it made huge headlines and received rave reviews. And so I was really intrigued by it, but I was almost resistant to play it because I was scared that if I played it, that I wouldn't like Microsoft anymore, that my kind of viewpoint would change.
Mm-hmm.
And also I couldn't afford to buy a PS3 at the time. So I kind of just, like, I refused to play it when it first came out. I had a friend that had a PS3 that kept inviting me over to play it, and I just kept saying no. I held out for a couple months, like a decent long while. What about you?
It, for me, it's weird because for the first game in particular, for Last of Us Part 1, I can't really exactly pinpoint in my memory, like, when I played it. Because I definitely didn't play it when it first came out. And, I in my head, it was, like, when we had the PlayStation in our apartment that we had with our close group of friends. I feel like that can't be right, though. It feels like it was too late, you know, but I don't know. It, to me, like, the playing that game, just, I think it was more about a feeling rather than a when for me, like how I felt playing it rather than where I was and when I was playing it, because it was the first time that I really was so emotionally invested in a game in a different way, right? I think, because I think a lot of people became Xbox fanboys because for what you said is that they were on the stick when it came to online.
Yeah. Like an online gaming. Multiplayer community, yeah. Xbox was superior by a margin.
So it felt very important to have an Xbox because, right, if you wanted to play with your friends, like, that's what you had to have. You had to have an Xbox. But I think that Sony very wisely kind of recognized, and a lot of these, you know, companies, they recognize their corner, right? And I think that Sony, as much as I would love for them to be better with their online stuff, I mean, they have definitely come a long way since then, but unlike some companies like Nintendo, looking at you, but basically I think that they realized, like, well, we can create, you know, a single player experience and have that be the driving force between, you know, we're going to make an entertainment system, not just a gaming system. Yeah. And I think that that's really what Sony went for. And they carried that thought process into their IP with games like The Last of Us, Uncharted, or, you know, even newer games like, what's it? God of War. And there's that other one, the one that's really unique. Where you walk around, it's got the guy from The Walking Dead's in it.
Oh,
Daryl from The Walking Dead.
Death Stranding.
What can I remember? Death Stranding. Yeah, like just like weird, like different, just like different out there experiences that they made exclusive on their console. But I never played a game where, like, at the end of it, I kind of just like slumped back in my chair and I was just like. I remember, like, just how I felt, like, finishing that game. And I was like, God damn. Like,
yeah.
I felt like I needed to take a break and just let it, like, decompress. It wasn't like, okay, like, on to the next thing. Like, it didn't feel as transactional as other games. And I think it's because of a lot of the things that they were doing. A lot of, you know, they were paying attention to making dialogue as realistic as possible. Like, if you listen to the dialogue in The Last of Us and compare it to games of a similar era, like, they were doing things way different. Like, they were, it was realistic. People interrupted each other in the dialogue. People were, you know, they didn't perform essentially a monologue and where another character just so happens to be present. Like, no, like, it was an actual dialogue with conversation that made sense. And I think that it made the connection to that game ever so more powerful because it just felt real. I don't know, from that moment on, I was like, I kind of rediscovered what I really liked about gaming, you know, was these single, like, these stories. Because I'd spent a lot of time, like I said, in my 2010s, like, and up until that point, even just playing a lot of multiplayer stuff, just not really even dabbling around with single player experience. So yeah, it's important to me, that game.
I think, sure. You know, it's especially noticeable now, but I think it started in like the late 2000s, early 2010s was bloat in games. So I think about the original Assassin's Creed, where it's basically like the same 9 objectives, copy and pasted throughout a map with the same like 3 side quests, copy and pasted. And they're all just, it's just artificial, you know, artificial lengthening of the game. Like the game, there's just so much extra bloat in the game that doesn't need to be there. And it's just for the purpose of making the price tag worth it. And I think that bloat really started to creep into a lot of third party games where a lot of the content was a disservice to the game, you know, and it didn't help the story, the clarity or the direction of the story, sure. And games like Mass Effect, where there was definitely some bloat. There was a lot of, you know, kind of like generic, procedurally generated, almost, you know, like side quests and stuff that are interspersed with the more interesting story. Like, a lot of these games did have, you know, kind of artificial sweetener, if you will, or just extra calories, just fluff that didn't need to be there, that didn't service the experience, but became kind of endemic to game development. And
yeah,
that's because, you know, video games were an entity that were growing, and I think people kind of found a formula that worked and started using it, and they've still used it, and that's kind of only been augmented through the years. And I think what made The Last of Us different from other games that contain great stories, like your BioShocks or your Mass Effects or your Shadow of the Colossi, whatever. yeah, is that it's not as much of a game as it is a curated experience. That there's one narrative. You don't have choices. There's a very kind of linear expanse for you to navigate. There are few collectibles. Like, there's no fat on that game. It is a beautiful cut of meat. And it plays differently slightly every time you play it, but it's the same experience because it's so finely curated for the user that when you play it, it's not like you're playing a game, but you're experiencing something cinematic and curated in a way that other games weren't. Yeah.
It feels like it's made for you, right? Like it's an experience made for you with the intention of making it last with you. And I think that was something that was missing from games for a while up until that point. I think a lot of these companies just got caught up in the sauce of making, you know, a big hit online. And then, you know, these things were, like you said, like there's nothing that The Last of Us does that's particularly like extra, you know what I mean? It's not like they, you know, there weren't collectibles. Like you said, like there wasn't any,
there's nothing extravagant. Like, it's revolutionary in its simplicity. That's
exactly like the gameplay aspect of it is very minimal when you really think about it. I mean, like the puzzles were, you know, like it had elements. I guess the thing that made it insane was, for me, like playing it was like, I love things like Zelda, right? Where like that is a puzzle game at its core, right? It's, you go into a dungeon or into a, I guess, are they temples? I can't even remember.
Yeah. Really dungeons, sad. Temples.
But you would go in and to progress, you would have to solve these puzzles. And like, that's an element that The Last of Us took forward, but did it in a way that was it was simplistic, but like they were doing it to embellish the story. And it was like a different purpose. It wasn't really about like showing what the cool things you could do in game. It was like, to, hey, let's put this puzzle here so that the characters can talk with each other and you can develop a relationship as a player with those characters. And like, that's, I really appreciate that, you know, they brought that back into gaming and kind of gifted that ideology to gaming because it's really the kind of games that I play now. Like, I look for story driven games as a result, which I guess leads into our final question here is like, what role has gaming played in your life? And how has it influenced other areas of your interests or identity? I think that's, for me, gaming is like, it's always been an outlet for creativity for me. And I mean, that seems like a very basic answer, but I mean, pretty much is. I mean, I've always been interested in stories. I read quite a bit. And for me, it's just a different way of consuming a story. It's, you know, it's a much more personal way of consuming a story. And I find it, you know, of course I find it enjoyable. I mean, it's like, why do you play games? It's like, well, because I have fun doing it. But I mean, I think it's influenced me in the sense that, like, I'm always looking for, like, I don't know. I would much rather put a controller in my hands and, you know, experience a game for what it is than to, you know, turn on a movie and, you know, watch a super rushed through rendition of a story that, you know, you don't get every bit and piece of the nuance that you wish you could get from a movie because it's only 2 hours long. You know, you get to have that and much more in a game. And I like that about it.
But yeah, I think it's because video games can provide so much. There's something for every mood. You could say that about any form of medium, right? But like a movie is a movie. It's something that you're going to play it on your, you know, you're going to sit back and you're going to watch it. You're going to engage with it the same way every time. And although, you know, there are different movies of different genres with different actors that are, you know, filmed with different styles and stuff, you engage with movies the same way. You sit and you watch them. Yeah, I guess you could say that of video games too, but you know, the way that you engage with a game like Halo and a game like The Last of Us are completely, completely different. You know, you're doing different things in those games. Like you explore them differently. You interact with them differently. They demand different things of you. They elicit, you know, they elicit different like physical reactions. You know, when you're playing, playing like a game like Dark Souls or Elden Ring for, you know, the zeitgeist, games that are exacting and challenging and demand your attention that are able to elicit like a physical, you know, adrenaline response, an autonomic, your nervous system is activated, like
anger.
Yeah, like horror movies can do that too, but I mean, you know, and then you can turn off and on the same console you boot up and you play a game that you're just kind of dicking around in rocket cars, and it's just the range of emotions that video games provide and the way that you're interacting with them, like it's not something that's happening to you. You are imprinting yourself on the game. It's just so powerful. And that's why I kind of turn to games as my primary outlet for pretty much everything. You know, if I need a challenge or I'm stressed and I just want to blow off steam, or I want to interact with a story and just get lost somewhere. You know, if I want to feel something, I'll play a Sony game and a really intense story. If I want to have, you know, if I want to create my own story, I'll turn on a Bethesda game and go into Fallout and create my own life, my own character, and build a base and, you know, create a narrative in my head about why I'm doing that. Even if that narrative doesn't exist in the game and there's no way to make it, it exists in my head, and that's what makes it fun. It's no different than the immersion that you feel in any other medium. And that's why I love games so much. They're just so versatile and immersive in so many ways.
Damn it, that was a good answer for the games of early 2010s. It was Fallout. Damn it.
Yeah.
That was a game that it for sure was. But yeah, I mean, that's... And what I mean, Skyrim came around then too.
Skyrim probably was 2011, so that was definitely,
yeah,
you know, right up till then, but...
Those, I think that those were the two games besides like multiplayer games that I was playing. Yeah. I mean, I could probably think, I mean, I'm sure that I guess that era was so, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. You were
no, you're going, but, I was done.
But I just think, as I sit here, I can think of a million other games that I've played. But I think that era was so, I remember more from my experience, and I don't know if this is necessarily a good thing or a bad thing, but I think it's something to take with you going forward. Is like, I just remember those games from like my childhood more, I think. I don't know why, but like, I think that everything in the 2010s kind of got muddled into one mix, a mixture of just an amalgamation of the same thing. And I don't know. It's
I don't necessarily have the same experience, but
yeah,
I kind of mark time by which video games I played. Like, if I can think back to 2017 and I remember what I did that year based off of what games I was playing at the same time. Like, I kind of chart the years based off of the games I was playing, the emotions I was feeling, like what I was thinking about. Like, that's like, games have such a ubiquitous impact on my life that I kind of chart the course of my life by the games that I'm playing at the same time.
That you know, it's funny, that feeling for me was the second Last of Us, actually. It was Last of Us Part 2. I can remember the time that I was playing it, like where I was. You know, that was when I was living on my own during COVID times. It was like a really, like, it was like a dark time to be playing a game, like living alone. And like, it was like a very, but I remember it, I think, because of that reason. Like, it was just like it was such a that game, which we will talk about in greater detail at some point, was a tough one to get through for a lot of people, because it came at a really like inopportune, but like almost like weirdly like fitting time. Yeah. like it fit the tone of the game almost too well, and it was just hard for a lot of people to get through. It was so dark.
Yep.
Such a dark game.
Me included.
Yeah. You had to take some time off from that one.
Yep. I still haven't beaten it, but I will.
Yeah. Oh my God. We gotta get you through that. The clock is the
I know
proverbial the clock is ticking. but yeah, I mean, those are the questions we had set out here, and hopefully, you know, if you're still listening, you could take something with you and kind of remember back to your initial gaming experiences, and you know what brought you here, and why you'll enjoy the world of The Last of Us so much, and games like it.
Yep.
Because,
and I hope you play along with us and experience it again with us, because it's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I can't wait. It'll be my fourth time playing
the game. Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, I think so. All right, guys. We'll talk to you next week.
Yes, we will. See ya.
See you. Thanks again for tuning into the Cordyceps Crew podcast, an unofficial Last of Us podcast. If you made it this far into the episode and enjoyed what you heard, please leave a rating and a review wherever you might be listening. Want to reach out to us in person? Feel free to email us at cordycepscrew@gmail.com, and we may feature your comment in a future episode. You can follow us on all of our socials, including Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube, for additional content and updates, all of which will be linked in the episode description. And that wraps it up for this week. We look forward to you joining us next week on this journey through The Last of Us. Thanks, guys.